Hello, it's John Dennis on Thursday the 24th of September. Today, G20 leaders meet in Pittsburgh after Barack Obama tells the United Nations, don't expect America alone to solve the world's problems.
Every nation must know America will live its values and we will lead by example.
I stand here to reaffirm the United Nations Charter, not to tear it up. I call on every nation to support its universal principles.
Also today, the pop group that's been likened to cockroaches because of its uncanny ability to survive the departure of all its original members.
Because it's pop music, so what is there really to believe in? You know, they're making songs at the moment about being sexy.
And I'm Michael White. In Bournemouth, from whence Lib Dem activists have been sent home to their constituencies by Nick Clegg with these words ringing in their ears.
If there's one policy you take away from this conference, one policy to mention on every doorstep, in every phone call, in every leaflet, let it be this one. We will deliver fair taxes.
But first, it's Sue Mansfield with the headlines and a look at the papers.
It's emerged US President Barack Obama has refused several requests from Gordon Brown for private talks at the United Nations General Assembly. President Obama has held one-to-one sessions with China, Japan and Russia, but The Guardian's been told his officials turned down five different requests from Britain. There have been tensions since the release of the Lockerbie bomber in spite of US requests. Number 10's denied the report, saying there have been plenty of occasions for Brown and Obama to talk at the summit meetings. After his meeting with the US President, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said he could now support sanctions against Iran. Both countries want Iran to pull back from developing nuclear weapons. Iran's supposed to meet the Big Six leading countries next week. The Russian president said he was prepared to support the USA after Obama decided to scale back the missile defense shield in Europe. At the UN in New York, world leaders have been making their speeches about the state of the world, as we'll hear shortly in Guardian Daily. Today they move to Pittsburgh for a meeting of the G20 group of richest nations. They'll discuss financial regulation and building a sustainable base for the world economy. US Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said action is urgent as the economy is stabilising, since time is the enemy of reform. Here in Britain, a 55-year-old man has found the biggest ever hoard of Anglo-Saxon gold using a metal detector. Terry Herbert found more than 1,500 coins and other gold pieces on a farm in Staffordshire. He says it took him 5 days to dig it all up, and there was so much he started seeing gold in his sleep. Two of the morning papers lead on Brown being snubbed by Obama, as and The Telegraph. Both take a similar line. The Telegraph believes that Obama's angry and that the Lockerbie fallout sees the special relationship sink to a 20-year low. Our political editor writes that Gordon Brown lurched from being hailed as a global statesman to intense embarrassment. The Times reports the only Iranian to win the Nobel Peace Prize has accused Britain of appeasing her government. The human rights lawyer told the paper that the West cares more about its security than human rights. The paper also puts a picture of the moon on its front page above a report that India's first lunar mission has found large quantities of water there. Three of the tabloids show another sad picture of Kate McCann, who's returned to Portugal for the first time since the disappearance of her child Madeleine. The Mirror quotes her saying that every day I cry for Maddie. And the Express and the Sun say that she will never give up her search for her lost daughter. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
As an extraordinary week for international diplomacy heads towards its climax, today the G20 summit gets underway in Pittsburgh. Yesterday, Libya's Muammar Gaddafi was among the world leaders addressing the United Nations. In a moment, we'll hear what Gordon Brown said. But first, here's Barack Obama in his maiden address to the UN.
I took office at a time when many around the world had come to view America with skepticism and distrust. A part of this was due to misperceptions and misinformation about my country. Part of this was due to opposition to specific policies and a belief that on certain critical issues, America had acted unilaterally without regard for the interests of others. And this has fed an almost reflexive anti-Americanism. Now, like all of you, my responsibility is to act in the interests of my nation and my people. And I will never apologize for defending those interests. But it is my deeply held belief that in the year 2009, more than at any point in human history. The interests of nations and peoples are shared. So for those who question the character and cause of my nation, I ask you to look at the concrete actions we have taken in just 9 months. On my first day in office, I prohibited, without exception or equivocation, the use of torture by the United States of America. I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed, and we are doing the hard work of forging a framework to combat extremism within the rule of law. Every nation must know America will live its values, and we will lead by example. Those who used to chastise America for acting alone in the world cannot now stand by and wait for America to solve the world's problems alone. We have sought, in word and deed, a new era of engagement with the world. And now is the time for all of us to take our share of responsibility for a global response to global challenges. The United States stands ready to begin a new chapter of international cooperation, one that recognizes the rights and responsibilities of all nations. And so, with confidence in our cause and with a commitment to our values, we call on all nations to join us in building the future that our people so richly deserve. Thank you very much, everyone.
I stand here to reaffirm the United Nations Charter, not to tear it up. I call on every nation to support its universal principles. As never before, the fate of every country rested on the actions of all. And as the fear of the unthinkable took hold, we reached a clear choice: to fail separately or to succeed together. If the forest nations are going to slow and stop deforestation, then I know that the richer countries must contribute financially. And that's why I proposed a new approach to financing our action against climate change. It will provide substantially increased additional and predictable flows. They will be flows of capital both from the public and private sector. I believe that this is too important an agreement for the global economy and for the future of every nation represented here simply to leave it to chance. So I urge my fellow leaders to commit themselves to backing up our official negotiators by going to Copenhagen too. It will take more than 100 years to deliver on some of our Millennium Development Goals. And 100 years is too long for the peoples of our countries to wait for the justice that has been promised. I believe that if we take the right decisions and work together, we are in the business of creating, for the first time in human history, a truly global society. It is an aim to be wished for and an aim to be fought for by all of us. Thank you very much.
I'm Ed Pilkington, and I'm at the UN building in New York, where it's been a big day today, the start of the General Assembly, in front of 192 member nations, each of whom get their chance to hold the international stage. This year is especially big, partly because of the range of huge issues facing the international community, from climate change to global economic meltdown, and partly because it was Barack Obama's first outing in front of the combined representatives of the world. As expected, Obama took head-on the poor reputation America has acquired in the eyes of much of the world. He talked about skepticism and distrust with which the US has been viewed, and the anti-Americanism that has been fueled as a result. He also talked in conciliatory terms to America's critics. He emphasized what he'd done since he's taken office, abolishing the use of torture, ordering the closure of Guantanamo, withdrawing troops from Iraq. But he also had tough words for Iran and North Korea, who he said would be held accountable if they did not meet their international obligations over the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Gordon Brown, flush from receiving a World Statesman of the Year award on Tuesday night for his work on behalf of the developing world, followed Obama's lead in stressing the need for growing global cooperation. He called it the search for a first in human history, a truly global society. Like Obama, he warned Iran and North Korea that further sanctions were in the offing if they continued to thumb their noses at nuclear inspectors. On climate change, there was another warning. He said that if the world failed to reach a deal in the upcoming Copenhagen summit on reducing global warming emissions, there would be no second chances. a pretty stark assessment. On Africa and the developing world, he used his turn in the limelight to repeat his appeal for a fairer deal for poor countries. The person who most caught the attention of the General Assembly and set it alight, perhaps for all the wrong reasons, was the Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi. Like all the other leaders, he was allotted 15 minutes, but he took 1 hour, 40 minutes to set out his stall. It was quite a performance. He insulted pretty much everyone in the room. He told the hundreds of delegates sitting in front of him that they were like orators at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. They made their little speeches and then disappeared without achieving anything. He then accused the permanent members of the Security Council, which include Britain and the US, of being a terrorist body not that different to Al-Qaeda. He called on George Bush and Tony Blair to be put on trial for the Iraq War. And then he even asked out loud, who killed JFK?
Jack Ruby, an Israeli, killed Lee Harvey. Who killed Kennedy? Why did this Israeli kill the killer of Kennedy? Then the killer of Jack Ruby, the killer of Kennedy, died ambiguously and mysteriously. We don't know before the trial. We have to open the files. The whole world should be. We read that Kennedy wanted to investigate the files of the nuclear reactor of the Israeli demand, and then it is to do with the Security Council. It is to do with the peace and security of the world, and then we should open this file. Why?
In any other situation, this is, after all, New York. It would have been a good slapstick show, but it was awkward for two reasons. First, outside the UN building, hundreds of protesters, including the families of Lockerbie victims, held a rally against him. And it was awkward, too, for Barack Obama, who, making his maiden speech to the UN General Assembly, just before Gaddafi, had wanted to carry a message of international leaders coming together to confront the many problems facing the world.
Ed Pilkington reporting. And there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/G20. Also on The Guardian's website, Mystery in the Arctic Sea. Luke Harding writes about what really happened when that cargo ship got hijacked. Guardian.co.uk/Russia. Our new columnist, or our returning columnist, we should say, Deborah Orr, asks, who are the middle class? Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And why we're all suffering from information overload. How to spot the symptoms and why it's happening, by Paul Hemp from the Harvard Business Review. That's at guardian.co.uk/G2. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, an interview from 2007 with a British soldier who was killed earlier this week in Afghanistan.
Just don't know where the job starts and ends. As you say, there's always a job to do, and, you know, the boys did it well.
But first, here's Michael White, our political commentator, who's been covering the Liberal Democrats Party conference in Bournemouth.
The first of this year's major conferences has drawn to a close, and as Lib Dem delegates made for their taxis, there was plenty for them to reflect on after a week of tentative policy commitments and some internal disagreements. In his closing speech yesterday, their leader spelt out the message he wants them to help him take to the country in the coming election campaign. The key one, he said, was fair taxes.
If there's one policy you take away from this conference, one policy to mention on every doorstep, in every phone call, in every leaflet, let it be this one. We will deliver fair taxes.
He attacked Labour. Of course he did. He wants Labour floating votes. Right at the end, his remarks were clearly directed towards Labour voters, or hacked off with Gordon Brown and much else besides.
Labour is lost. They haven't the ideas, energy, or vision to start again. So if you voted for them in the past, you have a choice. You can give away your vote to a fringe party. You can stay at home in despair. Or you can join with the Liberal Democrats and make the difference.
But of course you need two villains in a third party speech, and the other one of course was the Tories. He thinks David Cameron's a phony, a lightweight, a PR man, a con man as he called him in an earlier performance this week, but not yesterday.
Britain cannot afford to be taken in by David Cameron's illusion of change. Britain needs leadership from a party with real passion, and it's the Liberal Democrats. There is hope for a different future, a different way of doing things in Britain, if we are brave enough to make a fresh start. So let today be the day, the first day, of the future of British politics. It may be only the beginning, but it is the beginning of real change in Britain. If you want things to be different, really different, choose the party that is different. Choose the Liberal Democrats. Thank you.
So, a standing ovation there. You'd expect nothing less, of course you wouldn't, at a conference. Though the Lib Dems are less inclined to dramatic gestures towards their leaders than others. But was everyone convinced?
I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
What did you like particularly about it?
Well, I liked the way that he appealed directly to the electorate in general, not just us, but to everybody in Britain who is enthusiastic for real change.
Did you think he was looking for Labour voters or Tory voters there, or both?
I think both. People who are disappointed with Labour because they don't see Labour as a progressive party anymore.
Excuse me, sir, don't run away from us. Mike White from The Guardian was just asking people what they thought of the speech. Good one, bad one, terrific one?
I thought it was excellent. I think, yes, it was very inspirational. I think the series of very definite policy items where you're saying, you know, this is means change, that this is a fresh start. And I put it, and above all, the tax policy. I believe that we do need to increase taxes on the rich in order to relieve people at the bottom. And I think that I've always been in favour of, if you like, a more radical left of centre tax policy than has been the norm. And I think here is a shift that is very, very desirable.
Excuse me, madam, while you're waiting for your friend, we're just asking people for The Guardian what they thought of the speech. What were the good points?
Well, I think it was a very powerful speech. It was strong on all the issues that we think are important.
Such as?
Particularly the tax position on £10,000 before people pay tax. I think that's so important. The fairness in the tax system is something we really must introduce. It has been untenable that we have the poorest, so, you know, not paying their, you know, paying more than their fair share.
That was when he said, this is my key message at one point, didn't he? He said, it's tax and fairness.
Yes, well, I think that's always been a strong theme for us, tax, fairness, but it matters more now. And I think that's a key issue certainly for the constituents that I'm working to support.
Going home to work harder, are we?
I always work hard, but I certainly...
Even harder.
Even harder. I was certainly buoyed up by that speech. It was fantastic. So, thank you.
So, delegates left with a spring in their step, but there remain tough decisions to be made as policy discussion is distilled into firm manifesto commitments in the months ahead. I caught up with Paddy Ashdown, now Lord Ashdown, of course, and asked him, as an old campaigner in these things, just how well the week had gone for the party and for the man who holds the job he once had.
I think it's gone well. I mean, I think the one thing that we have achieved, not yet clarity of policy, that probably has to come, but it will come, I'm sure, because we've got the policy there. It's a question of choosing them for the manifesto to reflect the image. But the thing I think that has happened is it's greatly strengthened the image of Nick Clegg in the public's mind, and that I think is very, very important. We've got some glitches to iron out, let's be honest about it. But I think people now know him as a straight-talking guy who's prepared even to say the hard truths to his party. And I think you see a very clear example of how he's in charge now of a deeper team that includes Vince Cable, Min Campbell and others of skill.
You've done it. You've been there, got the T-shirt. Why? Does it take 2 or 3 years to establish your authority over a bunch of unruly individualists like the Lib Dem Party?
It's called democracy. This is not the Conservative Party.
Well, no, some parties are more individualistic than others.
Listen, this is how democracy should work. In the Conservative Party, policy is what the leader thinks it is, and he wakes up in the morning. Here you have a democratic structure, and not everybody agrees, and I remember very well. Does it take time? It takes time to be recognised by the public. I remember well going down to Victoria Station once at about the first year three of my leadership to get a taxi, and a whole bunch of slightly inebriated Welsh rugby fans said, yeah, there's that Steve Higgins, the snooker player.
They've seen you on telly, but they don't know quite
exactly
who you are.
Or are you their cousin, yeah, they forgot about. So, I mean, Nick, I think, has got through that barrier very fast, and we'll get through it overnight at the election.
Now, you said at the start policy issues to be ironed out. You didn't specify them. What did you in mind when you said that?
Well, we've got a stack of policy, Michael, but we've got to... We always do. But the next job is to write the manifesto, and that you then have to start putting those in priority lists. You have to say, this is the most important for us. I mean, mean, let's take a very clear example. Is it, as I think it is, most important to answer the primary question in people's minds in Britain today, and that is, how do I save my job? How do I manage to hang on to my house in the middle of an economic recession? We will have all sorts of policies we'd like to bring into operation, but if we can't persuade the British public that we know how to pay for those in the present climate, they're not going to believe us on anything else.
You're talking elegantly, as always, but you're still ducking your own question, which is things to sort out. I thought you would say that it's about the balance of tax and spend, the tone you adopt, savage cuts we had from the leader at the beginning of the week.
I just said to you, that's the issue the party now has to decide.
No, you didn't. You talked about jobs and houses, not quite the same thing at all. Nobody's proposing that they take their jobs and houses away directly, which is not in the gift of the government.
I don't think you're listening, Michael. Very unusually for you. Look, do you remember back in the 1980s, the issue was defence. In a sense, it was the key that unlocked the public listening to you on other things. It didn't.
You went for the retention of nuclear weapons, having previously been opposed.
The issue was, you have to be sensible on defence before they listen to you on anything else.
That's right.
I think the issue now is, you have to have a message for us on the economy before we listen to you on anything else. You have to prove to people that you know how to pay for your policies in the present circumstances. I think that is question number one in the public's mind, and before we start addressing the others, we have to have a sensible answer to that. That's why I think Nick is right in saying, look, these are hard and straightened times. Some of the things you'd like to do, you may not be able to do. Now, how they make the judgments about which of those they're going to do, that's an issue for the next 3 or 4 months, an issue for the assemblies or the manifesto.
So, what have we learned after a relatively sunny week by the sea in Bournemouth, in which I failed to get into the water? Clegg's performance, I thought more assured, bit long-winded, some colleagues say, but definitely more confident his third conference as leader. Not a great speaker, but good enough last night. Vince Cable, well, some of the wheels came off the Vince bandwagon. He's still their best bet. He is the most trusted politician in Britain, according to a recent poll, and you can see why. He clothes understandable economic language in the language of morality as well, and he does it well. Unfortunately, some of his figures a bit flaky on the cost of doing one thing and cutting another thing, and of course the colleagues got cross over his mansions tax, which he's been trying to peddle to them for years, and bounced them with it at this conference. They heard it on the radio first. Nuclear power, well, it's interesting. Gordon Brown this week said that maybe we'd have one fewer nuclear submarine. Won't impress anti-nuclear people, of course, but that's the sort of way the Lib Dems are thinking. They want to go a lot further. But more interesting, on civil nuclear power, they're not all linked in everybody's mind, military and civil. And we had a good debate on Tuesday afternoon where several people, including MPs, said, look, I don't like nuclear either, but I've looked at the figures. We've got a big energy gap looming when those nuclear power stations have to be decommissioned in the next few years. We need more green fuels, more alternative fuels, and we need clean coal technology. We haven't got it yet, but we're going to need, if we're realistic, keep the lights on, said Len Bidopic, we're going to need some nuclear. Party unity? Well, with an election coming, all parties are more or less united. This one had a few rows. We like a few rows. After all, that's real life, isn't it? As everybody knows who watches TV soaps, certainly who watches Parliament. So nothing wrong with that. The Lib Dems will be united. Clegg's their leader. It's his first election. Leaders have normally got two elections in them in the Liberal Democrat Party. He's hoping he can increase the number of MPs he's got, win more seats from Labour, than he loses to the Tories. That's what this is all about. Next week, we move along the south coast of Brighton, not very far away, where all eyes will be on Gordon Brown's performance and how he's treated by his party this miserable stage in his career. Recent Labour conferences have seen abortive coups and late-night resignations. I'll be back on Monday with all the news and back corridor rumblings, if there are any. I'm sure there are. Bye for now.
Michael White, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics, and Mike will be back on Guardian Daily next week with all the news and gossip from the Labour Party conference.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Acting Sergeant Michael Lockett was killed on Monday by a bomb while on patrol in Afghanistan. Back in 2007, the then Corporal Lockett was interviewed by The Guardian.
It is hard. You're the disciplinarian and you've got to be a good friend to them at the same time, but they're always there for you, all of them, and you've always got to be there for them 100% of the time, no matter where in the world you are. And we were in Brecon and I promised every lad that, you know, don't worry about it, we've been to Afghan before, not a problem. You know, you're always trying to boost their morale and give them, you're there to input the confidence into them. And to be lying in a ditch, knowing that your boys are shot, blown up, RPG'd, all that is a horrific, horrific amount of pressure that it puts on you. And I'm stood there, I'm lying in this ditch with a little card with everyone's name on, the ZAP number of their blood group, and I'm ticking off Bofa, missing in action, Johnson, T3, Cooper, Cole. You just go through and to have a little list, and you're marking men's name off, like, you know, I can't explain it, it's just horrible things to do. Lying in a ditch, getting shot at, and you've got a bloke missing in action. You've got three blokes that you can't find. It's horrible. It is absolutely horrible. We've now moved back into a safe area where they all feel safe, and you've asked them, lads, we need to go back out again. They just don't see any logic behind it. So I'm literally saying, look, boys, need to put your life on your line again for me. I'm going out. I want you to come with me. I need 9 volunteers. Both is out there. We've got a grid for him. We can see him in the plane. We need to go back out, lads. Who's coming with me? And initially, to be honest, there was only a couple of volunteers. Because only a couple of people volunteered to go out in the crying at me. And this is just killing me here. I'm about to go myself, but I've got to push that aside because there's a job to be done. So I give them a couple of minutes, and then it's literally, I've got too many volunteers. They're all coming with me. And that's them putting their lives on the line again for me, for the platoon commander. So I had to sit in the Viking by myself for a couple of minutes when we got back. And then both came off the back of the Viking. The doctor's obviously done his thing. It's now a case of, as bad as it sounds, he needs backloading. He needs to go back. And he needs to fly out. So myself and Sergeant Major stripping him of all his kit, taking day sack off him, covered in bullet holes, covered in blood, and you're emptying his kit out when he's got letters in there and, you know, photos of his wife and kid, and all you're doing is ripping his kit apart. And it feels like you're demoralising him. You know, you're stripping him of all his kit and then you're sending him on his way. It's horrible, horrible situation. And that's one of your boys that you've just promised that you'll take back. Just come off R&R, 3 weeks to do, not a care in the world. And he's going back to England in the wrong way. Again, rips you apart.
The late Michael Lockett, interviewed in 2007 by Audrey Gillen. And you can read Audrey's moving tribute to Michael at guardian.co.uk/military. The continuing career of the Sugar Babes, following the departure of their last original member, Keisha Buchanan, has raised questions about when is a pop group not a group? Comes, I don't know its destination. There have been bands who've had dozens of members throughout their career, but they've always had at least one musician who was there at the start. One commentator on the website Pop Justice said that even after a nuclear war, there will be cockroaches and Sugar Babes. I asked our music critic Rosie Swash whether Sugar Babes fans thought this was a lineup change too far.
Mostly, I think it has been complete disappointment. And we went on the MySpace page and there were comments underneath there, quite articulate for a MySpace comment, basically saying, this is the final straw, I won't be buying any more Sugar Babes albums. What's surprised me is that there was a blog on the Guardian website about just this subject matter, and you half expect the comments to be, why are you covering this rubbish? Don't you know there are more serious things? And everybody had an opinion on it, and it seems like there are more fans than you realise, that they actually are a really huge pop group with a wide fan base, and unfortunately a lot of those people seem to be completely against Keisha leaving.
Can
we bring yesterday
back around? Can bands bounce back from the loss of a key member?
From other key member, they definitely can. I guess, weirdly, it seems to happen a lot in metal circles. It's obviously as far away as we can get here. Everyone's been talking about Napalm Death, the death metal group, who can have no surviving members of the original lineup at all. How big they are, though, I mean, how much there is to survive when you're on that level is quite different. AC/DC and Van Halen both replaced their lead singers, who were completely integral to the sound. And we're also seeing Alice in Chains staging a comeback at the moment with a new singer, and it seems to be going really well. So it seems to be something that certain bands can get away with, provided the person they're replacing isn't the only, isn't the main focus of the group. For example, Nirvana never tried to go on after Kurt Cobain passed away. The members went off and did their own thing because it just would have been foolish. He was so integral to their
Although the Sugar Babes had passed that point. I mean, they did get rid of Mutya Buena, who many thought was the best singer in the group, and they did survive after that.
Well, so she might left. She wasn't forced out.
Right.
But so no one really knows what's going on. You know, you've heard a lot of rumours about the Sugar Babes and the bitchiness of the members involved and how they treat the new members and all this stuff. So no one really knows. She sort of said, I've had a baby and I need some time off. You don't really know what was going on there, but she did choose to leave, which I think is slightly different.
And she said that she'd happily reform the Sugar Babes with the original members.
I think that's a fantastic idea, because I honestly think the original formation with Siobhan Donaghy, who were, 1998, 11 years ago now, were absolutely fantastic. Their first album was, and what the key point is, it sounded completely different from any other pop music that was being made, but it was definitively pop music. It was their personality and their attitude, and they co-wrote a lot of the songs. Even though Siobhan was brought in after Mutya and Keisha decided to form the group, those two girls wrote the songs together and had an idea for what the group ought to be, which is completely different from what you're talking about now. I don't care
what they say. They are a sort of manufactured pop group, so maybe people shouldn't be too surprised when something like this happens.
They're more manufactured now than they were. They've never come as a complete set, that's true, and they're signed to Island, I believe, who obviously had a huge say in the direction of their music. And their music has changed considerably. When Heidi joined, they had their sort of comeback. I think I think that's the final piece in the puzzle to suggest to you that nothing that's happening in the music that's being made by this group really has anything to do with the members. With Keisha there, you could kind of believe that she was a presence who had an idea and a vision for what she wanted the band to be, which is perhaps why she got the chop. I said, okay,
Rosie Swash, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey, and in Bournemouth, Phil Maynard, were the producers of today's show. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.